try asking yourself why you meditate or why you want to meditate. Don't believe your first answers. Just write down a list of whatever comes to mind. Continue asking yourself. Also, inquire about your values, about what you honor most in life. Make a list of what's really important to you. Ask yourself, what is my vision, my map for where I am and where I'm going? Does this vision reflect my true values and intentions? Am I remembering to embody those values? Do I practice my intentions? How am I now in my job, in my family, in my relationships, with myself? How do I want to be? How might I live my vision, my values? How do I relate to suffering, both my own and others? Meditation develops full human beings. I'm told that in Pali, the original language of the Buddha, there's no one word corresponding to our word meditation, even though meditation might be said to have evolved to an extraordinary degree in ancient Indian culture. One word that is frequently used is bhavana. Bhavana translates as development through mental training. To me, this strikes the mark. Meditation really is about human development. It's a natural extension of cutting teeth, growing an adult-sized body, working and making things happen in the world, raising a family, going into debt of one kind or another, even if only to yourself through bargains that may imprison the soul, and realizing that you too will grow old and die. At some time or another, you are practically forced to sit down and contemplate your life and question who you are and where the meaning lies in the journey of life, your life. The old fairy tales we are told by their modern interpreters, Bruno Bettelheim, Robert Bly, Joseph Campbell, and Clarissa Pinkola Estes, are ancient maps offering their own guidance for the development of full human beings. The wisdom of these tales comes down to our day from a time before writing, having been told in twilight and darkness around fires for thousands of years. While they are entertaining and engaging stories in their own right, they are so in large part because they are emblematical of the dramas we encounter as we seek wholeness, happiness, and peace. The kings and queens, princes and princesses, dwarfs and witches, are not merely personages out there. We know them intuitively as aspects of our own psyches, strands of our own being, groping toward fulfillment. We house the ogre and the witch, and they have to be faced and honored, or they will consume us, eat us up. Fairy tales are ancient guidance containing a wisdom distilled through millennia of telling for our instinctual survival, growth, and integration in the face of inner and outer demons and dragons, dark woods, and wastelands. These stories remind us that it is worth seeking the altar where our own fragmented and isolated being strands can find each other and marry, bringing new levels of harmony and understanding to our lives, to the point where we might actually live happily ever after, which really means in the timeless here and now. These stories are wise, ancient, surprisingly sophisticated blueprints for our full development as human beings. One recurrent theme in the fairy stories is that of a young child, usually a prince or a princess, who loses his or her golden ball. Whether we ourselves are male or female, old or young, we each contain both prince and princess among countless other figures. And there was a time we each radiated with the golden innocence and infinite promise carried by youth. And we still carry that golden radiance or can recover it if we take care not to let our development arrest. Bly points out that between losing the golden ball, which seems to happen first around age 8, and taking any steps to recover it or even to recognize that it has gotten away from us, might take 30 or 40 years, whereas in fairy tales, which take place once upon a time, and therefore outside of ordinary time, usually it takes only a day or two. But in both instances, a bargain needs to be made first, a bargain with our own suppressed shadow energies, symbolized by a frog or perhaps by a hairy wild man who resides under the pond in the forest, as in Iron John. Before that bargain can be made, you have to know that these creatures are there, prince and princess, frog, wild man, or wild woman. Conversing with those aspects of our psyches that we instinctively turn away from into unconsciousness is a prerequisite, and that may be plenty scary, because the feeling state that arises is the one that comes when we go down into dark, unknown, mysterious places. The form of Buddhism that took root and flowered in Tibet from the 8th century until our day developed perhaps the most refined artistic expression of these terrifying aspects of the human psyche. Many Tibetan statues and paintings are of grotesque demonic beings, all respected members of the pantheon of honored deities. Keep in mind that these deities are not gods in the usual sense. Rather, they represent different mind states, each with its own kind of divine energy which has to be faced, honored, and worked with if we are to grow and develop our true potential as full human beings, whether men or women. These wrathful creatures are not seen as bad, even though their appearance is frightening and repulsive, with their necklaces of skulls and grotesque grimaces. Their terrible outward appearance is actually a disguise adopted by deities embodying wisdom and compassion to help us attain greater understanding and kindness towards ourselves and toward others who, it is understood, are not fundamentally different from ourselves. In Buddhism, the vehicle for this work of inner development is meditation. Even in the fairy tales, to get in touch with the wild man under the pond requires bucketing out the pond, something Bly points out takes repetitive inner work over a long time. There is nothing glamorous about bucketing out a pond or working at a hot forge or in the sweltering vineyards day after day, year after year. But repetitive inner work of this kind, coming to know the forces of one's own psyche, is its own initiation. It's a tempering process. Usually heat is involved. It takes discipline to tolerate the heat, to persevere. But what comes of keeping at it is mastery and non-naivete, attainment of an inward order unattainable without the discipline, the heat, the descent into our darkness and fear. Even the interior defeats we suffer serve us in this tempering. This is what Jungians call soul work, the development of depth of character through knowing something of the torturous, labyrinthine depths and expanses of our own minds. The heat tempers, rearranging the very atoms of our psychic being and most likely of our bodies as well. The beauty of meditative work is that it is possible to rely on the practice itself to guide us through the maze. It keeps us on the path even in the darkest of moments, facing the most terrifying of our own mind states and external circumstances. It reminds us of our options. It's a guide to human development, a roadmap to our radiant selves, not to the gold of a childhood innocence already past, but to that of a fully developed adult. But for meditation to do its work, we have to be willing to do ours. We must be willing to encounter darkness and despair when they come up, and face them over and over again if need be, without running away or numbing ourselves in the thousands of ways we conjure up to avoid the unavoidable.